Part 2. Given petitioner's concession, the complaint satisfies Rule 8A2. Ashcroft and Mueller admit that they are liable for their subordinates' conduct if they had actual knowledge of the assertedly discriminatory nature of the classification of suspects as being of high interest, and they were deliberately indifferent to that discrimination. Iqbal alleges that after the September 11th attacks, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, arrested and detained thousands of Arab Muslim men, and that many of these men were designated by high-ranking FBI officials as being of high interest, and that in many cases, including Iqbal's, this designation was made because of the race, religion, and national origin of the detainees, and not because of any evidence of the detainees' involvement in supporting terrorist activity. The complaint further alleges that Ashcroft was the principal architect of the policies and practices challenged, and that Mueller was instrumental in the adoption, promulgation, and implementation of the policies and practices challenged. According to the complaint, Ashcroft and Mueller knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject Iqbal to these conditions of confinement as a matter of policy, solely on account of his religion, race, and/or national origin, and for no legitimate penological interest. The complaint thus alleges at a bare minimum that Ashcroft and Mueller knew of and condoned the discriminatory policy their subordinates carried out. Actually, the complaint goes further in alleging that Ashcroft and Mueller affirmatively acted to create the discriminatory detention policy. If these factual allegations are true, Ashcroft and Mueller were, at the very least, aware of the discriminatory policy being implemented and deliberately indifferent to it. Ashcroft and Mueller argue that these allegations fail to satisfy the plausibility standard of Twombly. They contend that Iqbal's claims are implausible because such high-ranking officials tend not to be personally involved in the specific actions of lower-level officers down the bureaucratic chain of command. But this response bespeaks a fundamental misunderstanding of the inquiry that Twombly demands. Twombly does not require a court at the motion-to-dismiss stage to consider whether the factual allegations are probably true. We made it clear, on the contrary, that a court must take the allegations as true, no matter how skeptical the court may be. A court must proceed on the assumption that all of the allegations in the complaint are true, even if doubtful in fact. A well-pleaded complaint may proceed even if it strikes a savvy judge that actual proof of the facts alleged is improbable. Rule 12b-6 does not countenance dismissals based on a judge's disbelief of a complaint's factual allegations. The sole exception to this rule lies with allegations that are sufficiently fantastic to defy reality as we know it, claims about little green men or the plaintiff's recent trip to Pluto or experiences in time travel. That is not what we have here. Under Twombly, the relevant question is whether, assuming the factual allegations are true, the plaintiff has stated a grounds for relief that is plausible. That is, in Twombly's words, a plaintiff must allege facts that, taken as true, are suggestive of illegal conduct. In Twombly, we were faced with allegations of a conspiracy to violate Section 1 of the Sherman Act through parallel conduct. The difficulty was that the conduct alleged was consistent with conspiracy, but just as much in line with a wide swath of rational and competitive business strategy unilaterally prompted by common perceptions of the market. We held that in that sort of circumstance, an allegation of parallel conduct is much like a naked assertion of conspiracy in a Section 1 complaint. It gets the complaint close to stating a claim, but without some further factual enhancement, it stops short of the line between possibility and plausibility of entitlement to relief. Here, by contrast, the allegations in the complaint are neither confined to naked legal conclusions nor consistent with legal conduct. The complaint alleges that FBI officials discriminated against Iqbal solely on account of his race, religion, and national origin, and it alleges the knowledge and deliberate indifference that, by Ashcroft and Mueller's own admission, are sufficient to make them liable for the illegal action. Iqbal's complaint, therefore, contains enough facts to state a claim to relief that is plausible on its face. I do not understand the majority to disagree with this understanding of plausibility under Twombly. Rather, the majority discards the allegations discussed above with regard to Ashcroft and Mueller as conclusory, and is left considering only two statements in the complaint, that the FBI, under the direction of Defendant Mueller, arrested and detained thousands of Arab Muslim men as part of its investigation of the events of September 11th, and that the policy of holding post-September 11th detainees in highly restrictive conditions of confinement until they were cleared by the FBI was approved by Defendants Ashcroft and Mueller in discussions in the weeks after September 11th, 2001. I think the majority is right in saying that these allegations suggest only that Ashcroft and Mueller sought to keep suspected terrorists in the most secure conditions available until the suspects could be cleared of terrorist activity, and that this produced a disparate incidental impact on Arab Muslims. And I agree that the two allegations selected by the majority, standing alone, do not state a plausible entitlement to relief for unconstitutional discrimination. But these allegations do not stand alone as the only significant non-conclusory statements in the complaint, for the complaint contains many allegations linking Ashcroft and Mueller to the discriminatory practices of their subordinates. The complaint alleges that Ashcroft was the principal architect of the discriminatory policy, that Mueller was instrumental in adopting and executing the discriminatory policy, and that Ashcroft and Mueller knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject Iqbal to harsh conditions as a matter of policy solely on account of his religion, race, and/or national origin, and for no legitimate penological interest. The majority says that these are bare assertions that, much like the pleading of conspiracy in Twombly, amount to nothing more than a formulaic recitation of the elements of a constitutional discrimination claim, and therefore are not entitled to be assumed true. The fallacy of the majority's position, however, lies in looking at the relevant assertions in isolation. The complaint contains specific allegations that in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, the chief of the FBI's International Terrorism Operations Section and the assistant special agent in charge for the FBI's New York field office implemented a policy that discriminated against Arab Muslim men, including Iqbal, solely on account of their race, religion, or national origin. Viewed in light of these subsidiary allegations, the allegations singled out by the majority as conclusory are no such thing. Iqbal's claim is not that Ashcroft and Mueller knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject him to a discriminatory practice that is left undefined. His allegation is that they knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject him to a particular, discrete, discriminatory policy detailed in the complaint. Iqbal does not say merely that Ashcroft was the architect of some amorphous discrimination or that Mueller was instrumental in an ill-defined constitutional violation. He alleges that they helped to create the discriminatory policy he has described. Taking the complaint as a whole, it gives Ashcroft and Mueller fair notice of what the claim is and the grounds upon which it rests. That aside, the majority's holding that the statements it selects are conclusory cannot be squared with its treatment of certain other allegations in the complaint as non-conclusory. For example, the majority takes as true the statement that the policy of holding post-September 11th detainees in highly restrictive conditions of confinement until they were cleared by the FBI was approved by Defendants Ashcroft and Mueller in discussions in the weeks after September 11th, 2001. This statement makes two points. One, after September 11th, the FBI held certain detainees in highly restrictive conditions. And two, Ashcroft and Mueller discussed and approved these conditions. If, as the majority says, these allegations are not conclusory, then I cannot see why the majority deems it merely conclusory when Iqbal alleges that, one, after September 11th, the FBI designated Arab Muslim detainees as being of high interest because of the race, religion, and national origin of the detainees, and not because of any evidence of the detainees' involvement in supporting terrorist activity. And two, Ashcroft and Mueller knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to that discrimination. By my lights, there is no principled basis for the majority's disregard of the allegations linking Ashcroft and Mueller to their subordinates' discrimination. I respectfully dissent. Justice Breyer dissenting. I agree with Justice Souter and join his dissent. I write separately to point out that, like the court, I believe it important to prevent unwarranted litigation from interfering with the proper execution of the work of the government. But I cannot find in that need adequate justification for the court's interpretation of Bell Atlantic Corp. v. Twombly and Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 8. The law, after all, provides trial courts with other legal weapons designed to prevent unwarranted interference. As the Second Circuit explained, where a government defendant asserts a qualified immunity defense, a trial court responsible for managing a case and mindful of the need to vindicate the purpose of the qualified immunity defense can structure discovery in ways that diminish the risk of imposing unwarranted burdens upon public officials. A district court, for example, can begin discovery with lower-level government defendants before determining whether a case can be made to allow discovery related to higher-level government officials. Neither the briefs nor the court's opinion provides convincing grounds for finding these alternative case management tools inadequate, either in general or in the case before us. For this reason, as well as for the independently sufficient reasons set forth in Justice Souter's opinion, I would affirm the Second Circuit.